Oh, is it auto-tuned? Sounds auto-tuned. I can hear it from here.
It is auto-tuned.
Got very right. good ears.
But I think some of your music has been auto-tuned lately.
I don't know. Who knows? Who can keep up? Everyone. Everyone auto-tuned.
I just show up and sing what they tell me to.
Yeah, I just do what I'm told. I don't tell what I do. That's for the journalists and the paparazzi.
I like that your impression is so walk hard.
Yeah, it's the best I can do. It's the only way I can keep it consistent. Otherwise, it slips out into my own voice. Gotta go slow. Gotta go always surprised.
At the end, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. How interesting.
My go-to with John Lennon. Have you ever seen A Hard Day's Night?
Uh-uh, no.
There's a
I've seen many hard nights, but...
Oh, okay, well...
But that's personal.
but not on Blu-ray.
No.
At the very beginning, there's a man they've cast to play Paul's grandfather, and he's sort of the antagonist of the film. And he's sitting in the train car with the Beatles, and he walks in with Paul, and all the Beatles are like, "Hey, who's that little old man?" And so that's my go-to whenever I'm doing like John Lennon. I'm like, "Hey, who's that little old man, Paul?"
That's like your gateway phrase.
That's my gateway. And Paul's like, "That's my grandfather." And then George, it's a great line. George goes, "That's not your grandfather. I've seen your grandfather." And he goes, "Well, everyone's entitled to two, aren't they? This is me other one." I love it.
My gateway to Paul is just, oh.
Oh.
A humble listener is my Paul McCartney. Oh. Yeah.
My entry for Paul is always to argue with John and be like, "I don't know, John." Like,
oh, okay. Because I thought I was in charge. Even being underhanded and like, "Oh, that's oh. interesting. How about we just do it the way I said we should do it in the first place?"
And then Ringo in the corner like, "Oh, come on, guys, let's not fight, please."
"Oh, you think we shouldn't fight? Oh.
Why don't we just all join in and make fun of me nose? I've got quite the honker."
Toot, toot. That was Conscious Southern, sorry.
It's true, Paul. He's got quite the honker.
Oh, okay. You want to just do the same joke about Ringo's nose over and over again. How original. How interesting. Let's just sing karaoke while we're at it.
Why don't we all just talk about his drumming?
Let's just all take our pants off and wait and walk around with the booties.
The Beetle Boots.
Anyway, great. All right. Well, somehow we're gonna make that intro work. Hello, Dustin.
What's up?
I'm so tired. I went running today and I slept horribly last night as well.
Oh, no.
Well, I stayed up way past the time I'm trying to go to bed. And not only did I stay up, I wasn't even doing anything in particular. I was just like watching YouTube in my bed.
Yep.
And I ate like two bowls of Honey Nut Cheerios at like 1 a.m. And I was like, "This is a very bad decision." And I woke up and I was like, "Yep.
Yep.
That was a bad decision. I feel terrible." Yeah. So, I'm sleepy and I ran 3 miles today. And so like, I'm looking forward to sleep. So, and I also got the impression that I should quit drinking coffee. Not today, of course, but
right. Not today. So one day
soon, I found these caffeine, mints.
Hmm.
And I was like, "Ooh," because like,
it could be nice.
I like black coffee, but I don't think black coffee's been doing good things for my stomach.
Oh,
so, I'm sort of looking for a way out and I found these mints and I was like, "Ooh, snap."
give them a shot.
Yeah, I might do that. I might wait till summer so I don't have to like go anywhere. I don't have to take my kids to school.
Yeah, sure.
I'm worried about oversleeping or falling asleep at the wheel.
Do you find that caffeine affects you in terms of like being able to sleep at night or anything?
Sure. If I like really, you know, dance with the devil on it, it'll do something. But like if I, for many years, I was just always so perpetually tired that it didn't matter when I had coffee, I could fall asleep.
Yeah.
If I slept really well all week and I have it, like I could probably still have it at like 3 PM, but like there've been times where I've been sitting here like at night watching a movie, drinking coffee. And then of course those nights it's like, all right, well, that was dumb.
Well, it's weird because, you know, in the South, it's like a thing to have coffee after your dinner and have, you know, like your cake and coffee or whatever. And like when I was growing up, that was always the thing. Like I remember my parents doing that. I remember my grandparents doing it. Like you just had coffee late at night. Dang. I've developed a rule for myself that I don't have coffee or I don't have caffeine past 5 p.m. But the few times where I've broken that rule, I find that it actually doesn't really affect my ability to sleep. Like I genuinely believe I could probably have caffeine right before bed, like down a Coke and then brush my teeth and go to bed and be no problem. But I am curious about sugar. Like I think sugar might have more of an effect on me than caffeine. I don't know.
I'll let you know later. Cause I just ate a bunch of fruit snacks. Someone sent us like a big, like sample box thing or something.
Sure.
Ironically, since we were just talking about those, and so I just, to get it out of the way, I was like, I'm just going to go ahead and eat these fruit snacks because it's going to drive me nuts. So I'll let you know, because I had quite a many of them.
Okay.
Of course, I started running like a week ago. And so now my body is like, oh, we need stuff. We need stuff. Yeah. And so now it's like really hard not to eat everything.
Feed me, Seymour.
Please. You're probably not getting enough sleep. That's what I would venture. Because chemically, it should be, who knows?
Who knows?
I don't know what I'm talking about. What am I, a caffeine scientist?
Yeah. Are you a caffeinologist over there?
What am I, the Dr. Pepper? Caffeine scientist, Dr. Pepper?
Yes.
Anyway. All right. Well, we'll see how that goes. I'll update you. As it happens. So they should be getting here within the next week or so. And we'll see if it's a horrible experiment and in terms of like an investment or if my stomach just feels amazing. Cause I'll try anything at this point.
Correct.
Anything to avoid admitting that it might just be age.
Sure.
Cause then it's just like, oh, cool. Nothing I can do about this.
Can't fight that.
And it will only get worse.
Yep.
Hey, speaking of people who are old, Paul Giamatti is not a young man.
No.
But he's a young man at heart, as you'll see in the holdovers.
Sir, I don't understand.
That's glaringly apparent.
I can't fail this class.
Oh, don't sell yourself short, Mr. Coates. I truly believe that you can.
Every year at Barton Academy, students, faculty, and staff depart the campus for a two-week winter break. But there are always an unfortunate few who have nowhere to go for the holidays. They're known as the holdovers.
Mr. Hunnam.
Hello, Mary.
I heard you got stuck with babysitting duty this year. How'd you manage that?
You know, he used to be a student, right?
Yeah, that's why he knows how to inflict maximum pain on us.
I thought all the Nazis were hiding in Argentina.
Stifle it, Tully.
You just earned yourself a detention, sir.
Being here with you is already one big detention.
Son of a bitch, that's another detention.
Do you think I want to be babysitting you? No, I was praying your mother would pick up the phone or your father would arrive in a helicopter or a flying saucer.
My father's dead.
You don't tell a boy that's been left behind at Christmas that nobody wants him? What's wrong with you?
There's nobody here, okay? So you stay out of my way, and I'll stay out of yours.
Let me sleep.
Now, most of the kids dislike you, pretty much hate you. Teachers, too. You know that, right?
I find the world a bitter and complicated place, and it seems to feel the same way about me. I think you and I have this in common.
I don't think I've ever had a real family Christmas like this before.
Thank you, Mary.
You're welcome.
History is not simply the study of the past, it is an explanation of the present.
See, when you say it that way, and throw in some pornography, it's a lot easier to understand.
No matter what you are,
I'd like to propose a toast to my two unlikely companions.
Are you trying to lick down my shirt?
No. Yes. You're gonna get me fired.
This is your Rubicon.
Do not cross the Rubicon.
The Holdovers.
Ouch! Jesus! A terrible...
Maybe.
It's a decent segue.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't act too young at heart, really.
No.
Part of the plot is that he's kind of an old curmudgeon, I suppose.
I didn't say it was a good segue. I said it was decent.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go. All right. So The Holdovers is a film that came out in 2023. It was an Oscar nominee for several categories, Best Picture being one of them, Best Actor being another. It actually won one. So the film is directed by Alexander Payne, written by David Hemmingson, and stars Paul Giamatti, Divine Joy Randolph, who won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for this movie. A newcomer named Dominic Sessa.
Sessa.
And it takes place in 1970, like late, you know, winter 1970, at a boarding school in the Northeast. And Paul Giamatti is a professor there, and he is asked to babysit the holdovers, the kids who aren't going home for winter break for one reason or another. And it's one of those like crappy details that no one wants to do. And he gets stuck with it because some other teacher comes up with a lame excuse to get out of it. And because Paul Giamatti has no plans and never does anything or goes anywhere, they sort of just say, you need to do it. And so it's him and a few kids, this one in particular, and the lunch lady, or the cafeteria manager, sorry. They have some conversations and some hijinks and some, but not like, it's not a campy, like, woo, it's not a silly movie.
Yeah.
So don't get confused by my use of the word hijinks. How many of Alexander Payne movies have I seen? I've seen, okay. So you talked about Nebraska.
Yeah. I've seen Nebraska.
I never saw Downsizing. I saw The Descendants way back. I've seen Sideways once, but I haven't seen Election or About Schmidt, which I feel like are two classics of his.
Yeah.
I'm told all the time that I would love About Schmidt. We're not exactly scholars of Alexander Payne, but I can say that like sometimes, at least Sideways to me felt a little inaccessible, but I also watched it when I was like 16 or something. So who knows?
Sure.
Maybe I was a little inaccessible. But I like The Holdovers. I just thought I have a very simple, you know, assessment of it. I just think it's a nice little movie. It's very deliberately crafted to look and feel like an old school movie. And the kind of movie that feels like it doesn't get made anymore, where the stakes are pretty low and pretty personal and somehow still interesting. You know, where the plot doesn't involve a ticking clock towards someone being killed or, you know, some other very simple extreme stakes, like we're going to kill your wife if you can't find the thing in 3 days or whatever. Like it's just, let's just get through this break. And then we're going to deal with these emotional issues, in the course of that. And that's a lot harder to do in a way that's interesting, in a way that's engaging, and in a way that isn't boring. And I enjoyed this. I think that most people who would watch this would come out of it going, oh, that was nice.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Probably like a middle high star rating for me.
Sure.
Suppose. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I gave this like 4.5. I'm maybe a little too generous, but I did really enjoy this. And I can't really think of anything that I would have done differently or that I think that they, you know, dropped the ball on. I think that it's a well-acted film. The performances are all fantastic. And what's crazy about it is you've got this, like, range of talent, right? Like Paul Giamatti, who's been in everything, he's been acting forever. Divine Joy Randolph, who has like moderate experience, but not like, you know, she's not like super well known. And then Dominic Sessa, who this is his first film. And yet they all not only have a good chemistry with each other, but they are all like holding down scenes with each other despite their varying levels of experience. And I think that it's just a testament sometimes to the old saying of like, when you're in a scene with a good actor, it makes you a better actor.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's some of that going on here, but I also think that when you have a good script, it makes you a better actor. And I also think when you have a good director, it makes you a better actor. And I think all of those things are true here. So of course the performances would be good. The thing that wowed me was I started the film, I watched it on Peacock and at home. And so the, during the credits, like the opening credits, I was just utterly fascinated. And as soon as the credits were over, I thought now's a good time to pause it. So I paused it and immediately did a deep dive on like, how did they make it look like this?
Just the fact that there are opening credits.
Yeah, well,
was very quaint and interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and you think about like the way that those credits like kind of had a little jitter to them as if it was filmed. And to find out that this was filmed digitally is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because it was absolutely fooling me. I thought this is on film. Like this is a cool on film movie. And I looked and I was like, oh no, this is Ari Aleksimenis. And so I'm like just blown away by the craftsmanship here, because a lot of times when you do digital for film, it looks really artificial. And this looked so real. And I think that part of that, it's helped by the fact that so it's set in the 70s. They were very clearly mimicking the style of films made in the 1970s. So you have like a deep well of good material to pull from. And you can say like, okay, well, what was our contrast like? What did the color look like at that time? And you can kind of develop your own LUT based on that. And then, you know, kind of color grade it. And then I think they did some other stuff. So beyond just digital trickery, I think there was some printing on film and then, you know, going kind of back and forth between the two mediums. But it was initially captured on digital, and that's just mind blowing to me. And I loved the look of the film. Is it the best looking movie of the year? Maybe. That's a high bar, but maybe. It was so deliberately crafted. There are, during the opening credits, like this is such a small thing, but during the opening credits, I was fascinated by the shot composition of the credits, because it's, you know, shot in snow, and they had very clear compositions where they knew those titles were going to go. Mm-hmm. Like we know we're going to put the credits in this little patch of, you know, shoveled sidewalk because it's the only spot that white text would be legible. And so it's like the level of thought, like such a small thing, but the level of thought that has gone into this is just like it's hitting all the spots. We're 3 minutes in.
And to coordinate with production design too, because like you're telling them like, don't shovel this patch of snow with as much visual depth, because when there's text over it, it's better that it's blank and more like slate like versus like, if there's no text there, it looks big and ugly and too much in the foreground.
Yeah.
You'd want to like texture and taper it back to where there's actually like some texture and some depth to it. But if you're just going to throw titles on it, I'd just leave it as a opaque white hump. We'll put text on it, and then people will, you know, your brain will just go, okay.
Oh, okay. Yep. There it is. Yeah. It's such a well-crafted movie, like down to its opening titles. I thought it had a really, really great use of music, both of the period and of like score. And I think that it was, I just think every detail mattered, right? So you mentioned production design, right? You look at this, I mean, it genuinely looks like this was shot in the 70s. It does not look like these areas have been dressed. They have, yeah. But they look real. And some of it is because from the small amount of research I did, they shot in 5 different schools to make the one school. And that's because they had to find different schools that had not been updated since the 70s. And there were portions of schools that they could find that were that way. And so they were like, okay, we'll shoot the kitchen at this school because it's an old kitchen. We'll shoot the headmaster's office at this school because it's whatever. And what's great is all of this film, 100% of it was shot on location. So there's no sound stages. There's nothing crafted for the film. Everything was shot on location, and that gives it such a real lived in experience. From what I understand, Nebraska's that way. And I think a lot of Alexander Payne's films are that he just wants to shoot in real places. And, you know, there's this thing like, and I put it on my letterbox, like, why don't they make movies like this anymore? And I think that comes from a place like, we all know that they do, like, right. These movies do exist. They haven't stopped making real movies.
Yeah.
But the ones that people talk about, the ones that get all the press, the ones that everybody's wanting to, like, speculate on and theorize about and talk about with all their friends, those are the ones that are shot 100% on a green screen, and it has a really, like, ugly digital smear to the whole thing. And so, you know, it's easy to call out specific franchises, but like even things like, you know, the new Wicked movie, which is something that's pulled from Broadway. So you'd expect it to have extravagant, real built production sets.
Right.
And it's just this bleh of digital artifacts. And you have like, I don't know, man, it's just a different world. Like it gives you such a unique feeling to feel like, oh, I could go visit this place. This place is a real place. And everything feels textured and tactile in a way that we have not been able to really make a digital set feel that way. We've gotten very close. And I think with the proper care, you can fool me. And I've been fooled, right? There are things where I'm like, I don't know what's real and what's not real.
Mm-hmm.
But those are few and far between. It feels like our eyes have been trained to pick up on all of the artificialness of, you know, shooting on green screen, and it's harder to fool our eyes. But beyond that, I mean, you know, you look at something like, you know, the Hobbit films, versus like the Lord of the Rings, and you can see a very clear difference between the way that they approach the filmmaking. One of those feels really lived in and really real, and the other one feels really artificial. Mm-hmm. And I saw a clip the other day. It was like a behind the scenes clip of Cate Blanchett on set of The Hobbit, and she's, you know, doing some scene where she's, you know, Galadriel walking up this staircase, and everything was green. It was shot green walls, green floors, green ceiling, green stairs. There's nothing real. Ugh. And so I'm like, the thing is, you went through the trouble of building a green staircase and a green arched wall. You could have just built an arched wall and a stone staircase. It wouldn't have been that much harder.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's easy to pick on things like that, but it's so true that, you know, you can look back at like George Lucas's Star Wars prequels and all these things where it's just like an overabundance of CGI. And then what I think our brains do is when we see something like this, it's like, man, they don't make them like this anymore, but they do. We're just so used to seeing the other that we're, you know, it takes something like The Holdovers, which is just all around special and all around well-crafted, for us to like be shaken out of that like weird apathy we're in and be like, oh, this is what film is supposed to look like. And this is what film is supposed to feel like. And this is what cinema is. And I don't want to get too like, you know, preachy or, you know, or dramatic about like what cinema is supposed to look like, because obviously cinema can take many forms, but there is something really special about the way this looks and the way this feels.
The colorist they work with, Joe Gawler, who has done a lot of Criterion restoration, they say.
Mm. Oh, nice.
So he's like an expert in how film ages over time. Mm. And so they basically consulted and worked with him for how best to, because obviously originally they tried to like work with the film stock from the 70s and, you know, shoot it on film and everything. It just didn't, even when you're doing the exact thing you're thinking of, the real materials don't even yield you the vision you want. So you go for digital, you go for handheld, and you go for, you know, post, and post is actually good enough now with the right people to where you can achieve this look digitally, which is crazy. Cause you know, cause we were always taught, and of course the principle of the thing is always, you know, don't leave it for post, like achieve it, achieve it on the front end if you can. But in this case they couldn't.
And
it's amazing that they could in post so well, but that's a big credit to this guy, Joe Gawler, just knowing his stuff. And everywhere I go, I look at this film, everyone talks about the look. I keep saying this, but yeah, the older I get, the more I appreciate production design and like real sets and real props and just real set design and set dressing. And, you know, when you go back to a time like the 70s where decorations were a little more garish or just odd choices in the way houses were built or decorated, the amount of like brown in this film, that's very 70s. It's also very New England and very academic. So it's a good color palette for this movie. I've always loved Paul Giamatti. He's great. But I'm really glad he's getting a lot of recognition, because I feel like he has, I don't know how many times he's been nominated over the years, but I feel like the last time we talked about how good of an actor, I feel like the last time we, the culture, talked about how good of an actor Paul Giamatti is was like around the time he did John Adams, which was like 20 years ago.
Yep.
And which I've not seen. I hear it's good. But of course, anytime you watch any movie and there's Paul Giamatti, I don't know a single person who could say sincerely that they go, oh, geez, not Paul Giamatti.
Yes.
Every time he shows up, you're like, yeah,
sweet. Yeah.
I was watching The Truman Show and there's Paul Giamatti. He's like one of the guys that works for Ed Harris. And he's doing the Paul Giamatti voice when he's like, when Ed Harris is like, hit him again with the lighting. He's like, no.
Yeah. Yep.
He's going to drown. He's going to drown in the water. He doesn't even care. Hit him again. No.
Do you remember Paul Giamatti was in Big Fat Liar with Frankie Muniz?
That's the first exposure I had to him.
Me too. That's the craziest thing.
Cause like you see him and you're like, oh, this goober. And then you realize like, oh no, I'm a goober because I didn't know who this guy is.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Big Fat Liar. He was really good in, The Ides of March, the George Clooney movie, with Ryan Gosling and Evan Rachel Wood, like that, the movie about the politics one. That's a movie I keep coming back to over the, I own it. I watch it every now and then. And it's just one of those movies that's like this in a way where it doesn't knock your socks off, but you would come back to it and go, man, it's just well crafted. And part of it is the performances, and one of those performances being Paul Giamatti. He's so good in The Ides of March.
Yes.
And that's just a show where people are just talking about elections.
Mm-hmm.
Again, like There's no big acting scene. It's not a deep drama or a biopic, but for some reason, like movies where, yeah, maybe there's an arc, but movies where people are just talking and there's not as much dramatic weight. Somehow those are more magnetic to me. And I don't know if it's just because the artifice of film is removed from it, where, you know, when you're watching a drama, you can very easily remember frequently that you're watching a film. You're watching someone acting. Yep. And sometimes when you're watching a movie where, like a movie like The Ides of March, where Paul Giamatti is a side character and Ryan Gosling is the one who's trying to think over something, you know, and Paul Giamatti is just giving him information and delivering it convincingly.
Yeah.
But there's something about a scene like that where you just go, and I don't know if it's just me being fixated on writing and therefore like being more responsive to fun dialogue and just engaging dialogue versus people who are more in tune to cinematography or performances. I don't know. I don't know what that is, but those are the little things to appreciate about movies like this, where, you know, this to me, The Holdovers isn't a writer's film. It's an actor's film. It's a cinematographer's film. You know, the strengths of this movie are not the wheelhouse I normally can key in on. Which is a testament to it, because those elements are so good here.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. I haven't said one word about the script, which is fine. Yeah. You know, like that should speak volumes about those attributes.
Yeah, for sure. And I think if we're going to not talk about the script, I won't harp on it, but I will say great script, right? Like totally solid. You know, if you just read it, I think it would be just as good. Like, obviously the actors bring something to it. Obviously the director brings something to it, but you know, the script, it's a good script. It's a great story with a good structure. And, a lot of things happen that I did not expect, right? Like, I didn't know anything about this going in. Like, I didn't watch a trailer. I knew before it was nominated for an Oscar and all that. I knew this was on my list because just of Paul Giamatti, and Alexander Payne.
Yeah.
And I was like, I liked Nebraska enough. Like, I'll just see this. And, so it was on my list, but I didn't know anything about it. So I was shocked when all of the other Holdover kids leave.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, so this is just about the one kid. Like, that's really smart.
Yeah.
And it reminded me, obviously it's not, but it reminded me of like Psycho, where you think the film is about something.
Yeah.
Like, I thought, oh, this is going to be like The Breakfast Club set in the 70s, you know?
Right,
and,
right.
And it's like, oh, no, it's not at all. It's just about this guy.
It's one of those where you go, oh, good, good. Because where it goes is less treaded territory than with the ensemble of precocious, diverse kids. He was like, I'm the, you know, you got the Asian kid and like the Jewish kid. And I was like, okay, this is a pretty eclectic set of people. Like, this will be fun, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And then they leave and you're like, ah.
Oh, okay. Cool. I got you.
Cool.
Yeah. And it's such a good way of like making the script more economical, right? And saying, okay, we're just going to tell the story and we're just going to tell it well. And you would think that a story like this would suffer because it's really just about three people, like in every single scene. And eventually you'd tire of it or you'd feel like, come on, I need a B plot here or something to, you know, just change it up. Because it is. I mean, it's just a lot of people talking. We go here and talk, then we're going to go there and talk, and we're going to go over here and talk. And, but it's super entertaining throughout. And you do get B stories, right? Like you have a protagonist story, you have, the supporting characters' stories, and then you have all of these varying, things within it. Like, will Paul Giamatti's character, find romance with this other, you know, faculty member at the school, and and all of these things that are super interesting, add dimension and tell us something about the characters. They're in service of the characters, even if they're not necessarily in service of the story or of the plot, but they eventually do get woven in there. And there's a lot of cool, like, things to break up just the monotony what would be the monotony of three characters only talking over and over and over to each other. And that's a skill that I don't have as a writer to say, okay, for 2 hours, make three characters interesting. I don't know if I can do that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like that takes a lot, like what kind of character can you tell without the audience growing tired of them? And then you start to, like, as a writer, you'd start to think, okay, well then I have to make these characters really likable or really interesting. And here they're like, nah, we're just going to make kind of all the characters, really the two main characters kind of unlikable at times. Mm-hmm. And that's really smart. What strikes me the most as the film progresses, and I'm not going to get into spoilers here. I'm just going to say that as the film progresses, you reach a point where the film kind of comes full circle. And when we arrive back at the start of our circle, you really realize how much things have changed. Mm-hmm. And it was a very small incremental change. So like I could see somebody who's maybe not super keyed in, or maybe they're like watching this in the background while they do like fold laundry or do something else. They might be like, there's nothing happening.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. Like nothing, there's no story here. Nothing's going on. It's boring, whatever. But if you're watching it, it isn't boring. And if you're watching it, you'd pick up on the small things, because what's happening here, the way I'd explain it is Paul Giamatti's character starts closed and kind of just like surface level. He's the, you know, college professor or the high school teacher that everybody had that they hated. And slowly we're going to just start peeling back all the layers of this character, and we're going to start revealing him, but that doesn't happen all at once. That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
There's no big moment where like a huge proclamation is made. It's small. It's small revelations, and every scene, you know, works towards revealing either his character or Angus Tully's character, and you start to really peel back these layers. And so in a way, the plot is incidental. The plot doesn't matter as much. We're taking two characters who are opposites and who don't get along, and we're slowly peeling the layers back to where maybe they can appreciate one another in a way that they didn't see coming. And I think that that's a great way to structure this. It's a great thought to have. And I think I would have done the worst version of this, which is, you know, how do I make this interesting? I gotta jazz it up. Maybe was the school gonna close? We're not gonna have enough funding. Yeah. You know, we're gonna throw something in that's like a, you know, some sort of element to raise the stakes. You don't need it. It's not about the story. The story does not matter.
Maybe Paul Giamatti finally drinks too much of that Jim Beam or whatever he drinks, and he burns down the gym or something.
Right. Yeah. Some, you need some big moment. You've got to have some huge turning point. And this movie's like, no, you don't.
No, nope.
Just keep going. Just keep peeling slowly back. And you're like, oh, but where's the big set piece? The one that's in the trailer. And they're like, I don't know. Like,
shut up. Talking? We don't need it. Be quiet.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, I agree with everything you just said. I think that sometimes just less is more, and this movie is almost like the less it tries to like wow me, the more interesting it becomes.
Yeah, yeah.
And the there's something to be said just for good performances, good production design, good screenplay, and just a very simply executed movie.
Sure.
Something about, I think that mainstream studio filmmaking has tricked us into thinking that movies need a bunch of like pizzazz, even if it's not like CG, it needs some injection of crazy energy for us to engage with them. And that might be true to an extent, but we always talk about there's no movies for adults. This is a movie for adults. And, and I felt rewarded as an adult for being given a much more even keeled and consistent movie absent of dopamine spikes that are just designed to wake me back up.
Yep.
And that's not to say that, I mean, I talked about Poor Things, and Poor Things has a bunch of crazy contemporary feeling energy to it. And, you know, very in some visual spectacle, but it still focuses on the interesting things it's doing. It's just a different, it's a lot more tongue in cheek and comedic than The Holdovers is. Again, like, I didn't watch a trailer. I didn't even read about the plot. I didn't know what the holder, I didn't know anything about it. Except that he was a teacher. And if it didn't star Paul Giamatti, I don't even think I would have checked it out. I would have just been like, oh, but because it's Paul Giamatti, you go, this character, I will at least, like, he's so watchable that whatever this is about will probably be worth my time. That's a testament to, you know, the right actor.
Yeah, for sure. We talked a little bit about visual effects, right? We talked about how it's great that this is shot on location and all that. But I would be remiss if I did not shout out Crafty Apes, who created the visual effects for this film, which was essentially a lot of environmental work. Adding snow, adding invisible texture. Invisible stuff that makes a huge difference. And, and if you go to Crafty Apes' website, you can see their breakdown, their VisFX breakdown.
I love those.
And it's really great because it's like, you know, there's a shot where a helicopter lands at the school. And they shot that and there's no snow at all. And so it's adding the snow, adding in all of that. And it's, you know, all the invisible stuff that's great. And so this film is not without visual effects. I'm not saying that. But I will say, you would never know it. And that's a huge testament to their work.
The first time I became aware of the subtle art of visual effects was in the special features of A Beautiful Mind, which is another film that makes very ample, but subtle use of visual effects.
For
plot reasons. There's a reveal at the end of A Beautiful Mind where you understand why these birds needed to be CG. But but even in like 2001, you can't tell those birds are fake. And that's a time in cinema where you could tell a lot of shit was fake. Not those birds. Not when Ron Howard's in charge. Ron Howard's not going to make any lame ass birds. Ron Howard expects the top tier birds.
That's exactly right.
Give me the best birds you have. Get the best bird assets. Go into the, your best bin. Get me the best birds.
The best birds. I was in Andy Griffith's show. I feel like, I think he ends every sentence that way. Huge respect to the VFX people who are out there creating invisible work, right? Like that's what VisFX was and should be, is like completely invisible, not the overabundance. And I'm going to pick on it again. I'm so sorry. Ant-Man Quantumania, where nothing is real, nothing looks real, nothing feels real, nothing even looks appealing. There's no appeal. There's no clever design work, nothing. It's just they hit random on the computer buttons.
Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, they I wonder if Quantumania is gonna be our new Amazing Spider-Man. Like the film we just come back to is an example of
what not to do. Yeah. Probably
the new whipping boy.
Yes. Probably. But it's deservedly so. And I feel like you know, if you stack this film up against Quantumania, what you realize is these are two different types of films.
Yes.
Right. Quantumania is not aiming to be Holdovers.
No.
So they're on two completely different tracks, but the truth is they don't have to be. And this is what's increasingly becoming the thorn in my side, is you can still aim to give people an escapist good time without sacrificing good visuals, texture, without sacrificing, you know, a story that puts character first. You don't have to make those sacrifices. You can do both. And that's what I hope to see more of. And if there's any lesson to be learned, I think there is an appetite for this type of content. And I hope, I pray that Hollywood is listening and learning, that we don't need, we just don't need what they're giving us. And if they would fund filmmakers with visions who want to tell a story that fires on all cylinders, then they could do that and probably save a lot of money and probably make a lot of money. And that's that.
That's the thing. Like, if you, just the one benefit of, guys, this is going to save you a lot of money.
Yeah.
Like, forget that. Like, I understand maybe you don't care the movie's good. I understand maybe you don't care that, like, you know, whatever, that's not a sure thing, but don't you care about saving money?
Right. Well, so the holdovers, production budget was $13 million.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, it's a very
low,
quaint movie.
Yeah.
I'm going to see what it made at the box office worldwide. 42 million.
Yeah.
So it's not bringing in Ant-Man numbers. Well, no. Ant-Man's not a great example, but it's not bringing in Marvel numbers.
But that's three times its budget.
But that's three times your budget. You know what I mean? And it's kind of worth it, right? Like, okay, you're not making billions, but it's worth it because this is now going to be seen as a, one, an Oscar-winning film.
Yeah.
And two, as a film that is universally liked. Like, it's got a 90-something on Rotten Tomatoes, both critics and audience scores.
Yeah.
It's a universally well-liked film. Sometimes it's okay to make a movie that doesn't make you $1 billion because it brings your studio clout. And you can kind of learn that from A24. A24 is now here creating movies that are making billions and billions of dollars. But what they are doing is developing a brand. And that brand is, if you watch the A24 film, it's going to have something to say. It's going to feel auteur-ish in some way. And we're not making junk.
Yeah, like it used to be that studios, like, and they would have like these subsidiaries and these other smaller studios or production companies like Miramax with this film, where the goal, it wasn't, even if the film had not made money, even if it had made $10 million, $5 million, the film was never meant to make a profit. It was meant to raise the studio's profile as a serious artistic studio.
Yes.
Like, that's why studios would make like lower, like Helen and I were talking about recently, like lower bandwidth, easier to digest, like action films that are there to put asses in seats and make money and entertain people. And then you'd also balance that with a slate of dramatic award worthy films that were a bigger risk. And so if they didn't make money, you never really expected them to. And you know, you didn't matter because you're flush from making, you know, Predator 3 or whatever.
Right.
Maybe that's a bad example, but you know, but you know what I mean? Like the whole idea of like, that's what you do. You take some risks, but you mitigate those risks by taking safer projects also.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's okay to invest, because at the end of the day, anytime you make a film, like talking as if I'm a studio executive, anytime you make a film, it's an investment. And sometimes the investment is in a profitable return. And sometimes the investment is in what it's doing for my brand.
Yep.
And it's okay. It's like, look, this is either not going to turn a profit or it's going to turn a mild profit. And that's okay because it's going to bolster my image.
Yep.
And if I can attract other filmmakers who do want to tell stories, like, you know, imagine if you had a film studio that sure, you know, made high budget, you know, crowd pleasing films, blockbusters. But at the end of the day, you also created those artistic films. You might just attract people like Scorsese.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you have both on your hands.
Yeah.
Which is what you really want. That's the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
The Holy Grail is I want a film that wins Oscars and makes me a boatload of money.
Yeah.
Universal, everybody's still tracing their Lord of the Rings, right?
Universal's laughing all the way to the bank that they got to land Chris Nolan after he walked away from Warner Brothers because he made Oppenheimer, a film that won a bunch of awards, including Best Picture.
Yep.
And made almost $1 billion.
Yeah, exactly. That's what everybody wants.
Yeah.
And they want the Barbies and they want all of these things, but they're few and far between and they're not without hard work and attracting good people. And you don't attract good people without a good track record, and you don't get a good track record without making sometimes risky investments.
Yeah. No one likes a cheapskate who bets on a sure thing. You know,
right,
nobody
right,
respects
exactly.
an executive who is simply making the daddy corp more money.
Yes.
You respect people who take risks and go, oh shit, man, that was pretty ballsy.
Yeah.
Paid off though. I like you.
Right.
You're dangerous.
Yep. Yep.
So hot.
But that's it. Like that, then that's what I hope people are starting to learn. It's like take your risk. And shrink your budgets, right? We said this when we talked about Godzilla Minus One, which won an Oscar as well.
Yep.
You know, is it Minus One?
Yeah.
Is that what it's called?
Okay.
Yeah. I second guessed myself. it's that same sort of deal. It's shrink your budgets and the crowds will come. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm curious what that made, but,
we talked about it. I remember at the time, I think it made like 30 something or something modest.
114 million.
Oh, maybe its budget was 30.
Budget was like 15, I think.
Yeah, 10 or 12, it says here. Okay. Yeah, I'm just wrong.
But yeah, I mean, but that's the thing. Like, if you can make a Godzilla movie for 15 million dollars, there's no reason on earth to spend $300 million on an Indiana Jones movie, right? Like, I've said that before, but that's the truth. And so, yeah, I don't know. I hope they learn all the right lessons, because I think the audiences are trying to tell them what we want. And I don't know if anybody's listening, but we're trying, right? Oppenheimer, Minus One, Holdovers. This is what we want.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll listen one day and stop giving us the Marvels.
At least you didn't say Ant-Man again.
Yeah, well, I had to change it up.
Sure.
But, and Marvel's just the easy punching bag. But I could have easily said Aquaman 2.
Aquaman 2, yeah.
The Flash.
I'll
throw Star Wars in there.
Yeah.
Any Star Wars thing from the last decade. There's just no, I don't know. We're trying to tell them. Until then, we have movies like The Holdovers, which is worth your time and has a great visual palette for your eyes. And, enjoy.
Palette for your eyes.
Yeah. It's not even what I'm trying to say, but good night, everybody.